to one of the pirogues. While some of the men were employed in this necessary labor, Lewis wrote, others were dressing skins, washing and mending their clothes, etc. Captain Clark and myself killed each a buck immediately on landing. The deer were very gentle and in great numbers. After a detailed description of the trees in the river bottom, he regretted that clouds during the day and night prevented my making any observations. He reported on what had been related to him by scouts who had gone up Corvus Creek to have a look around. Vast herds of buffalo, deer, elk, and antelopes were seen feeding in every direction as far as the eye of the observer could reach. Lewis went to see for himself. Having for many days past confined myself to the boat, he opened his September 17th entry, I determined to devote this day to amuse myself on shore with my gun and view the interior of the country. He set out before sunrise, accompanied by six hunters. They encountered a grove of plums. Lewis described the trees, then wrote, This forest of plum trees garnish a plain about 20 feet elevated. The whole of the plain, nearly 3 miles by 3 miles, was entirely occupied by the burrows of the barking squirrel, prairie dog. This animal appears here in infinite numbers. The shortness of the grass gave the plain the appearance throughout its whole extent of beautiful bowling grass in fine order. This scenery, already rich, pleasing, and beautiful, was still farther heightened by immense herds of buffalo, deer, elk, and antelopes, which we saw in every direction, feeding on the hills and plains. I do not think I exaggerate when I estimated the number of buffalo which could be comprehended at one view to amount to 3,000. At 8 o'clock a.m., Lewis and his companions rested ourselves about half an hour and regaled ourselves on half a biscuit each and some jerk of elk. Then they set off to kill a pronghorn. Lewis found the pronghorns to be extremely shy and watchful, insomuch that we had been unable to get a shot at them. I had this day an opportunity of witnessing the agility and superior fleetness of this animal, which was to me really astonishing. I pursued a small herd of seven. Bad as the chance to approach them was, I made the best of my way towards them, frequently peeping over the ridge with which I took care to conceal myself from their view. I got within about 200 paces of them when they smelt me and fled. I gained the top of the eminence as soon as possible, from whence I had an extensive view of the country. The antelopes had disappeared in a steep ravine, now appeared at the distance of about 3 miles. Lewis was struck by the rapidity of their flight. It appeared rather the rapid flight of birds than the motion of quadrupeds. I think I can safely venture the assertion that the speed of this animal is equal, if not superior, to that of the finest blooded courser. And with that, the entry suddenly breaks off. There is no ending describing the campfire that night, with the men talking of the strange and wonderful things they had seen. Either Lewis put down his quill, not to take it up again until April 1805, or what he wrote is lost. Over the next week, in the southerly winds of early fall, the expedition sped ahead, making 23, then 25, then 33 miles in 1 day. The captains finally shot a coyote and added a mule deer to their list. On Sunday, September 23rd, they made 20 miles and camped on the starboard side in a cottonwood grove. As some men set up tents, others gathered firewood, and the cooks got their kettles ready, 3 teenage Teton Sioux swam across. With Driard exchanging messages with them via the sign language, they said there was a band of 80 lodges camped at the mouth of the next river, and a second band of 60 lodges a short distance above the first. The captains gave the boys 2 carats of tobacco and told them to inform their chiefs that the expedition would come up tomorrow for a council. The expedition proceeded in the morning past a 2-mile-long island where Coulter, with the last horse belonging to the expedition, had camped for the night and killed 4 elk. He had hung them on trees along the shore. Lewis sent a pirogue to pick up the meat. As it was being loaded, Coulter ran up the bank to shout that Indians had stolen his horse. Soon after, the captain saw 5 Indians on the bank. They anchored the keelboat and spoke to them, either through signs flashed by Driard or by using the old Frenchman, Pierre Cruzat, who could speak a bit of Sioux, as interpreter. The captains were stern. They said they came as friends, but were ready to fight if need be, and warned that they were not afraid of any Indians. They told a little lie, saying that the stolen horse had been sent by the new father of the Red Children as a present for the chief of the Tetons. They said they would not speak to any Tetons until the horse was returned. The expedition arrived at the mouth of the next river, at the site of present Pierre, South Dakota, late in the afternoon. As a defensive precaution, the party anchored the keelboat off the mouth of the river. The captains put the party on full alert, with one-third ashore on guard, the other two-thirds camping on board the boat and pirogues. In the morning, the captains raised the flagstaff, set up the awning, and prepared for a council, taking the precaution to leave a majority of the party on board, with the keelboat anchored 70 yards offshore so that its swivel gun commanded the site. At 11 o'clock a.m., three chiefs and many warriors came in, bearing large quantities of buffalo meat as a gift. The captains offered some pork. Then it was time to talk. To their dismay, the captains quickly discovered that Crozat could not speak the language beyond some simple words, nor could Driard convey via the sign language the relatively complex thoughts and proposals Lewis was making in his basic Indian speech. Recognizing the difficulty, Lewis cut the speech short and began putting on the traveling medicine show. It started with a close-order drill by uniformed troops marching under the colors of the Republic. Then came the air gun, magnifying glass, and the rest. Finally, Lewis handed out medals and gifts to the chiefs. He designated Black Buffalo as the leading chief present and gave him a medal, a red military coat, and a cocked hat. The other two chiefs, named the Partisan and Buffalo Medicine, got medals. As far as the captains were concerned, they had completed their part. "That's all?" the Tetons demanded, unbelieving. "Some worthless medals and a silly hat?" Sensing the discontent, especially from Black Buffalo's rivals, the Partisan and Buffalo Medicine, the captains invited the chiefs on board the keelboat, where they gave each a quarter glass of whiskey. The chiefs were exceedingly fond of it. They took up an empty bottle, smelted it, and made many simple gestures, and soon began to be troublesome. Clark detailed a party of 7 men to help him put the chiefs ashore. The chiefs resisted and had to be forced into the canoe. When it landed, 3 warriors seized the tow line while another hugged the mast. The Partisan pretended drunkenness and staggered up against us, declaring I should not go on, stating he had not received presents sufficient from us. His insults became personal. He demanded a canoe load of presents before he would allow the expedition to go on. Clark would take no more. He drew his sword and ordered all hands under arms. On the keelboat, Lewis ordered the men to prepare for action. The swivel gun was loaded with 16 musket balls, the blunderbusses were loaded with buckshot, the men threw up the lockers as breastworks, loaded their rifles, and prepared to fire. Up the bank, 20 yards from Clark and the pirogue, some warriors saw Lewis preparing the swivel gun and began to back away, but others strung their bows and took out their arrows from their quivers, or began to cock their shotguns. It was a dramatic moment. Had Lewis cried, "Fire!" and touched his lighted taper to the fuse of the swivel gun, the whole history of North America might have changed. Here is one possible scenario. The cannon roared, spitting out 16 musket balls. The blunderbusses roared, spitting out buckshot. The muskets roared, spitting out aimed lead bullets. Sioux warriors were mowed down in the dozens. But there were still hundreds of warriors on the bank, and even as the smoke lifted, they filled the air with arrows and kept them coming, for they could reload and fire at a much faster pace than the American soldiers. Lewis and Clark, prime targets, went down. With the captains incapacitated or dead, Sergeant Ordway rallied the survivors, got into the keelboat, pushed off, and retreated downriver. In short, had that cannon fired, there might have been no Lewis and Clark expedition. The exploration of the Missouri River country and Oregon would have had to be done by others at a later time. Meanwhile, the Sioux would have been implacable enemies of the Americans and in possession of the biggest arsenal on the Great Plains. For some time to come, they would have had the numbers and the weapons to turn back any expedition the United States could send up the Missouri. They would have increased their trade with the British Northwest Company coming out of Canada. In the War of 1812, they would have been British allies, perhaps strong enough to wrest Upper Louisiana away from the Americans and make it part of Canada. Improbable, certainly. Impossible, almost certainly. Still, aside from the possible long-range consequences, the confrontation on the riverbank was threatening to make it impossible for Lewis to carry out his orders with regard to the Sioux, to make a good impression on them and make them into friends of the United States. This was the moment Jefferson had had in mind when he told Lewis in his formal orders to exercise caution. If Lewis recalled that order, he ignored it. He refused to back down and continued to hold the lighted taper over the swivel gun. Nor would Clark decline combat. He kept his sword out of its scabbard. Their blood was up. They were Virginia gentlemen who had been challenged. They were ready to fight. So the white leaders pushed the moment to its crisis. Luckily for them, one of the red leaders stepped forward to avert hostilities. Black Buffalo seized the tow line from the three warriors and motioned to the warrior hugging the mast to go ashore. As they did so, the partisan, sulking, joined his warriors on the bank, 20 yards off. The Indians kept their bows strung. Lewis remained at full alert, ready to fire. Disaster had been avoided, but the crisis continued. Clark turned on the Indians. "I felt myself warm and spoke in very positive terms," he wrote in his journal. He made dire threats. He said he had more medicine on board his boat than would kill 20 such nations in one day. He told Black Buffalo that the expedition must and would go on. He said his men were not squaws but warriors. How much of the threat the Indians understood from Driard's sign language and Crusot's simple words cannot be known, but surely Clark's body language spoke plainly enough. While he was haranguing the Indians, the crew took the pirogue back to the keelboat, where a dozen soldiers jumped in. When the reinforcements got to the bank, some warriors backed off. Then the three chiefs went into conference. Clark awaited the outcome, justifying his actions to himself. "Their treatment to me was very rough," he wrote, "and I think justified roughness on my part." But then he managed to quiet his emotions sufficiently to walk over to the chiefs and offer his hand. The chiefs refused to take it. Clark turned on his heel, ordered his men to join him, and waded out to the pirogue. Before he could set off for the keelboat, Black Buffalo and two warriors waded after him. They indicated that they wanted to sleep aboard the boat. Clark nodded his consent. "We proceeded on about 1 mile," Clark recorded, "and anchored out off a willow island, placed a guard on shore to protect the cooks and a guard in the boat, fastened the pirogues to the boat. I call this island Bad Humored Island, as we were in a bad humor." The first meeting between the Sioux and the Americans had gone badly. Certainly, Lewis and Clark had failed to make the favorable impression on the Sioux that Jefferson had ordered them to do. But short of giving away almost a fifth of their total stock, the contents of one pirogue, there was nothing the captains could do to make that favorable impression. At least no shots had rung out. No arrows had been launched. In the morning, the captain set out early and proceeded some 4 miles. The banks were lined with hundreds of curious but anxious Indians. At Black Buffalo's request, the expedition came to and anchored near his village. The captains invited some men, women, and children to come aboard. Black Buffalo invited Lewis to visit his village. The chief appeared disposed to make up and be friendly, so Lewis consented. The village Lewis visited was a classic nomadic town based on a buffalo and horse economy, numbering about 100 teepees with a population of around 900. These were the Brule band of the Tetons, and they were in high spirits, having only 2 weeks previously won a great battle against the Omahas. The Sioux had killed 75 Omaha warriors and taken 48 women and children prisoners. Crusot, who was with Lewis, could speak Omaha fluently. Lewis told him to find out what he could from the prisoners. Black Buffalo was insistent on showing Lewis the greatest courtesies, including repeated invitations to take a squaw. The Indians made frequent solicitations for Lewis to remain one night longer so that they could show their good disposition towards us. Lewis agreed. In the late afternoon, Clark and the entire party came to the village. Clark saw the Omaha prisoners and judged them a wretched and dejected-looking people. The squaws appear low and coarse, but this is an unfavorable time to judge of them. At dusk, Clark and Lewis were carried with much ceremony on a decorated buffalo robe to the great council lodge in the middle of the village. Fires glowed through translucent teepees as the women prepared a feast. Slabs of buffalo meat roasted over hot coals. Inside the council lodge, 70 elders and prominent warriors sat in a circle. The American sat beside Black Buffalo. In front of them, a 6-foot sacred circle had been cleared for holy pipes, pipe stands, and medicine bundles. After smoking, Black Buffalo spoke with great solemnity. The captains could not make out what he was saying, beyond that the Sioux were poor and the Americans should have pity on them and give them something. Clark answered that the Sioux should make peace with the Omahas, and as a gesture of their goodwill, release the prisoners they held. If Black Buffalo understood the translation of that idea, he must have thought Clark mad. Why should he give up valuable prisoners just to please the white man? And anyway, his people were about to hold a scalp dance, displaying those so recently acquired from the Omahas. It was the first Sioux scalp dance ever seen by Americans. Clark described it. A large fire made in the center, about 10 musicians playing on tambourines made of hoops and skin stretched. Long sticks with deer and goat's hoofs tied so as to make a jingling noise, and many others of a similar kind. Those men began to sing and beat on the tambourine. The women came forward highly decorated in their way, with the scalps and trophies of war of their father, husbands, brothers, or near connection, and proceeded to dance the war dance. Women only dance, jump up and down. Every now and then, one of the men come out and repeat some exploit in a sort of song, this taken up by the young men, and the women dance to it. The Americans tossed presents of tobacco and beads to the dancers and singers. When one warrior thought he had not received his due, he flew into a rage and broke one drum, threw two others into the fire, then stormed out of the dance line. The drums were retrieved and the dancing went on. Sergeant Ordway found the music delightful and said it was done with great cheerfulness. The dance broke up at midnight. Black Buffalo offered the captain's young women as bed partners. Clark, who understood the meaning of the offering, wrote later that a curious custom with the Sioux is to give handsome squaws to those whom they wish to show some acknowledgments to, but the captains said no. Black Buffalo and the partisan then accompanied the captains to the boat, where they slept for the night. During the night, Crouzat came to the captains to report that the Omahas had told him that the Tetons intended to stop the expedition and rob it. The captains agreed they would show no sign of a knowledge of their intentions, but they slept poorly. It apparently failed to occur to them that the Omaha prisoners had an obvious motive for stirring up the Americans, and might well be lying. In the morning, Clark and Lewis went back to the village. They trod cautiously, suspecting treachery, and therefore are at all times guarded and on our guard. They again offered me a young woman, Clark wrote, and wish me to take her and not despise them. I wavered the subject. That evening there was another scalp dance. It broke up about 11 o'clock p.m., with both captains scarcely able to stay awake. The partisan and one of his warriors accompanied them back to the bank. Clark got into a pirogue to be ferried out to the boat, while Lewis stayed on shore with the guard. Some clumsy steering brought Clark's pirogue slamming broadside into the keelboat's anchor cable. It broke. The boat began to swing dangerously. Clark called out in a loud voice, "All hands up! All hands up and at their oars!" The shouted orders and the hustle and bustle that immediately followed alarmed the partisan. He began hollering that the Omahas were attacking. In 10 minutes, the bank was lined with some 200 warriors, led by Black Buffalo, prepared for anything but believing that the Omahas really were attacking, since they had genuine cause to want to make a surprise raid, and half suspecting that the Americans were in an alliance with their enemies. Misunderstanding cut both ways. Lewis, on shore with a small guard, was convinced that the partisans' shouting was the signal for the intended treachery. He had his men on full alert, rifles primed. Fortunately, the potentially explosive situation quickly resolved itself. When the warriors realized it was a false alarm, they returned to their beds. Lewis returned to the boat, which, because of the lost anchor, had to tie up to a tree under a falling bank, much more exposed than the captains would have liked. Clark concluded his journal entry for the day. All prepared on board for anything which might happen, we kept a strong guard all night in the boat. No sleep. In the morning, after a long, fruitless search for the anchor, the expedition prepared to set out. At that moment, the Tetons appeared on the bank in great number, well armed. Black Buffalo came on board and asked the captains to stay one more day. Simultaneously, several warriors grabbed the bowline. Clark complained to Black Buffalo, who hurried forward to tell Lewis that the warriors only wanted some tobacco, and then the expedition might proceed. He wasn't asking for much. A carat or two of tobacco was all. A trifle, merely. But as a symbol, Black Buffalo was demanding what the captains thought of as a high price. It was an acknowledgement of the right of the Sioux to exact a toll from white men using their river. Lewis's patience broke. He said he would not be forced into anything, ordered all hands ready for departure, had the sail hoisted, and detailed a man to untie the bow cable. As the soldier began to untie it, several warriors again grabbed the rope. The partisan demanded a flag and some tobacco as the price of their letting go. Clark threw a carat of tobacco onto the bank, saying to the chief, "You have told us you are a great man, have influence. Take this tobacco and show us your influence by taking the rope from your men and letting go without coming to hostilities." Clark backed his sarcasm with action. He lit the firing taper for the swivel gun and moved toward it. Black Buffalo stepped forward. He declared the expedition free to go if only the captains would give some tobacco. Again, the captains refused, Lewis saying they did not mean to be trifled with. It was Black Buffalo's turn for a bit of sarcasm. He said that he was mad, too, to see us stand so much for one carat of tobacco. Perhaps stung by the remark, but still trying to retain his own sense of dignity and control, Lewis contemptuously threw some carats of tobacco to the warriors holding the bowline. With that, Black Buffalo jerked the line from their hands, and the boat cast off. The Teton confrontation was over. The expedition left breathing hard and breathing fire. Clark hollered out to a young Indian ashore to pass the word, "If they were for war or were determined to stop us, we were ready to defend ourselves." But behind the bravado, there was no sense of triumph. The captains had not made a favorable impression. They had just barely avoided a disastrous exchange of fire. They were exhausted and still nervous. They came to on a very small sandbar in the middle of the river and stayed all night. "I am very unwell for want of sleep," Clark concluded the day's entry. "Determined to sleep tonight, if possible." In the morning, September 29th, the expedition got an early start. The partisan and two warriors called out to the boat from the bank. They indicated they wanted to hitch a ride up to their village, not far distant. Captain Lewis absolutely refused, stating very sufficient reasons and was plain with them on the subject. Lewis said the party had already wasted 2 days with the Sioux and had to be getting on. Given the hot tempers on both sides, it was just as well. No matter how long Lewis and Clark stayed with the Sioux, they were not going to make them into friends except by giving more than they could afford. Lewis and Clark had not initiated hostilities, but their insistence on standing their ground might well have led to bullets and arrows flying through the air. Clark was defensive in writing his account. Presumably, Lewis also would have justified his actions. But to a superior officer looking over the report, he would have looked headstrong and rash. His orders to make every effort to establish good relations with the Sioux had been turned on their head. Lewis and Clark had managed to get past the Sioux, but the Sioux were still on the river, capable of blocking any later expeditions and in a rage at the Americans. And there was a good chance the expedition would have to pass the tribe again on the return trip. But for now, the Sioux were behind them. The wind was from the south. The men hoisted the sail, and the boat made 20 miles that day. In the evening, once again on a sandbar island, the safest place to be, the captains refreshed the party with whiskey. It was a cold evening. Migrating geese flew downriver, honking through the night. Fall was here. It was time to get on, as far north and west as possible, before winter set in. Chapter 15. To the Mandans. Fall 1804. If there ever was a time in which the Lewis and Clark expedition bore some resemblance to a bunch of guys out on a long camping trip, it was in the first part of October 1804. Fall on the Missouri River in the Dakotas was a delight. On a cloudless day, and many were in the first 3 weeks that October, the great plains of North America stretched out beyond the horizon under an infinity of bright blue sky. The sun had gone past the equinox and was dropping lower in the sky each day, so the shadows were growing longer. On the plains, the hills, and bluffs, their grasses turned a golden brown, gleamed in the sunlight, or threw off long shadows up and down the valleys, creating a masterpiece of light and shade. Nights were coming on sooner and lasting longer. They brought frost, which meant no more mosquitoes. The men built the fires up a little higher than in September, and gathered closer around as they talked about what they had done and seen that day, and what they expected tomorrow. In the first 2 weeks of the month, the days started off cool, but by mid-morning the temperature was perfect, and stayed so until an hour before sunset. The great mammals of the plains were gathering into herds. Many of them, including elk, pronghorn, and buffalo, began their mass migration to their wintering grounds. Sooner or later on their trek, most of the herds had to cross the river, thereby creating one of nature's greatest scenes. Overhead, Canadian geese, snow geese, brants, swans, mallards, and a variety of other ducks were on the move, honking and quacking as they descended the river. The fowl and mammals were in prime condition, which meant that the buffalo ribs, the venison haunches, the beaver tails, the mallard breasts, all dripped fat into the fire as they were turned on the spit, causing a sizzle and a smell that sharpened already keen appetites. For Meriwether Lewis, it was a magical time. He spent most of it exploring, walking on shore, venturing out into the interior, catching up with the boat at night. Sometimes he went alone, say for his dog, Seaman. At other times he took a small party with him. He was a great walker, with long legs and a purposeful stride, capable of covering 30 miles in a day on the plains. As he walked, he was constantly at full alert, his eyes sweeping across the horizon, then coming down with complete concentration on a stone or a plant or an animal den at his feet. He carried his field journal so that he could note down new plants, animals, minerals, the general lay of the land, the apparent fertility of the soil, the types and numbers of game animals around him, and more. He wore moccasins of doubled-up buffalo hide, pants made of broadcloth, a fringed deerskin jacket, and a three-cornered leather hat. He carried a compass, a knife, a pistol, a powder horn and balls, some jerky, and his notebook in his knapsack. He had his rifle in one hand and his espontoon in the other. He was an excellent marksman, his skill even greater thanks to the espontoon, a sort of pike about 6 feet in length with a wooden shaft and a metal blade. It was a medieval weapon still in use as a symbol of authority for infantry officers in the U.S. Army, carried by Lewis because it was a most useful implement. Aside from being a walking stick and a weapon of last resort, the espontoon had a crosswise attachment at shoulder height that served as a rifle rest. Given the weight of his rifle, more than 8 pounds, and the length of the barrel, more than 4 feet, he needed a support. Lewis always had his rifle primed with the bullet, wadding, and powder charge set in place, so that when he saw a target, he had only to set his espontoon vertically on the ground, measure out the powder for the pan, swing his rifle up to the rifle rest, slip in his flint, bring the hammer to full cock, aim, and fire. If the target was within 100 yards and bigger than a mouse, he usually got it. He didn't always have to shoot to collect a specimen. On October 16th, he glanced down and saw at his feet a sleeping bird. He didn't know the species, but recorded that it was of the goatsucker family. He picked it up. It was alive, but appeared to be in something approaching a dormant state. Lewis brought it back to the boat. 2 days later, when the morning temperature was 30 degrees, the bird could scarcely move. "I run my penknife into its body under the wing and completely destroyed its lungs and heart," Lewis reported. yet it lived upwards of 2 hours. This phenomenon I could not account for unless it proceeded from the want of circulation of the blood. A few days later, on October 20th, in the vicinity of present Fort Lincoln State Park, across the river from Bismarck, North Dakota, Private Cruzat was the first to encounter a grizzly bear, called a white bear by the Americans. They had heard about the grizzly and knew the Indians were afraid of the bear, which, according to rumor, was gigantic in size. Clark had recently seen a footprint and pronounced it by far the biggest he had ever seen, and ferocious in behavior. The men of the expedition, naturally, were eager to get a look and a shot at it. Cruzat was the lucky one. Except, as Lewis dryly recorded in his field notes, he wounded him, but being alarmed at the formidable appearance of the bear, he left his tomahawk and gun. Cruzat returned to the scene an hour or so later to retrieve his tomahawk and rifle. Soon after, he shot a buffalo cow, Lewis wrote, and broke her thigh. The cow pursued him. He concealed himself in a small ravine. The little incident highlighted a major problem for the hunters. After they had fired their rifles, they were nearly helpless until they reloaded. Beginning in October, as the expedition made its way through present northern South Dakota, it passed numerous abandoned villages composed of earth-lodge dwellings and cultivated fields. Some of the fields, although unattended, still had squash and corn growing in them. These had once been home to the mighty Arikara tribe. About 30,000 persons strong in the year the United States won its independence, the tribe had been reduced by smallpox epidemics in the 1780s to not much more than one-fifth that size. Another epidemic swept through in 1803-4, devastating the tribe. What had been 18 villages the previous year had been reduced to 3 by the time Lewis arrived. On October 8th, the keelboat passed a 3-mile-long island near the mouth of the Grand River, home to the 3 villages of living Arikaras, about 2,000 Indians altogether. The island was one large garden, growing beans, corn, and squash. Arikaras lined the banks, watching the boat progress to the head of the island, and then watching the men make camp on the starboard side. Lewis selected 2 voyagers who spoke the Arikara language, and 2 soldiers, took a pirogue, and paddled across to meet the Indians on the island. Clark stayed in camp, posting guards on shore and sentinels on the boat and canoes, with all things arranged both for peace or war. Lewis obviously did not know what kind of reception he was going to get, but he did have expectations. From what he knew, or thought he knew, the Arikaras were farmers oppressed by the Sioux. The reality was that the Sioux brought trade goods to exchange for Arikara crops in a mutually beneficial relationship. He knew the Arikaras were at war with the Mandans. He believed that they were the key to American diplomatic endeavors on the Missouri, because, in Lewis's view, if the Arikaras could be broken away from the Sioux and if they made peace with the Mandans, the whole balance of power on the river would shift. The Sioux would be isolated and then frozen out of the coming American trade empire. James Ronda comments that Lewis and Clark shared a naive optimism typical of so much Euro-American frontier diplomacy. They believed they could easily reshape Upper Missouri realities to fit their expectations, but to the surprise of the explorer diplomats, virtually all Indian parties proved resistant to change and suspicious of American motives. So Lewis had cause for high hope as well as for apprehension as he paddled across to the island, and finally, cause for relief as he received a warm welcome from the Arikaras. Best of all was meeting Joseph Gravelines, a trader who had been living with the Arikaras for 13 years. He was an invaluable source of information on the Upper Missouri country, and his command of English, French, Sioux, and Arikara made it possible for Lewis to communicate swiftly and accurately with the Arikara. A large part of the problems with the Sioux had been the result of inadequate, incomplete, incompetent translation. With Gravelines's help, Lewis could expect to do much better with the Arikaras. Lewis pumped Gravelines for 2 or 3 hours, then asked him to bring a delegation to the expedition's camp in the morning for a council, and hired him as interpreter. In the morning, the wind was kicking up waves in the river higher than Clark had ever seen. He was astonished to see bull boats brought to the bank, boats made each of a single buffalo hide stretched over a bowl-shaped willow frame, and five or six men get in, with three squaws to paddle them. The Indian women pushed off, and despite the waves and wind, crossed the river quite uncomposed. They brought with them some chiefs, some warriors, and Pierre-Antoine Thabot, the trader with another of the island villages. Thabot had been born near Montreal and educated in Quebec. In 1776, he had gone west as an engagé in the fur trade. He had lived in Illinois, then Missouri, and finally with the Arikaras. He, too, was an outstanding translator, Arikara, English, French, Sioux, and source of information. But even the best translators could not overcome the difficulties of the wind, which was whipping up sand and making a roar. The council was put off till the next day. On October 10th, Thabot came over first. He warned the captains that there was some jealousy among the chiefs of the three villages. Then the chiefs themselves, and some of their warriors, came to the council. After smoking and an exchange of small presents, Lewis stood and began speaking, with Gravelines interpreting. It was his basic Indian speech, according to Clark, providing the Indians with good counsel, which was to accept American sovereignty, to make peace with the Mandans, to shun the Sioux, and to trade with American merchants. If they did as told, they would be protected by their new father, the chief of the 17 great nations of America. When Lewis finished, a detail fired three shots from the bow swivel gun. When the smoke cleared and the Indians recovered from their astonishment at the first cannon they had ever seen or heard, the captains brought out gift bale number 15, marked and prepared for the Arikara's use months before at Wood River. There was vermilion paint, pewter-looking glasses, 400 needles, broadcloth, beads, combs, razors, 9 pairs of scissors, knives, tomahawks, and more. It is something of a puzzle why they were not so generous with the Sioux. No whiskey. The captains offered it, but the Arikaras not only said no thanks, they shamed Lewis and Clark by remarking that they were surprised that their father should present to them a liquor which would make them act like fools. For the chiefs, there were military coats, cocked hats, medals, and American flags. Despite Thabot's warning, the captains made Crow at Rest the first chief, on their unshakable assumption that every tribe had to have a single leader. They made Hawk's father and Chief Hay, leaders of the other two villages, as second chiefs. After the presents, Lewis shot off his air gun, to the by now customary astonishment of the Indians. The council broke up, the chiefs promising to consult with their warriors and respond to Lewis's words the following morning. That afternoon, the men visited the villages. York was a sensation. His size was impressive enough, but the Arikaras had never seen a black man and couldn't make out if he was man, beast, or spirit being. York played with the children, roaring at them, chasing them between lodges, bellowing that he was a wild beast caught and tamed by Captain Clark. The captains finally told him to stop because he carried on the joke and made himself more terrible than we wished him to do. The soldiers, meanwhile, enjoyed the favors of the Arikara women, often encouraged to do so by the husbands, who believed that they would catch some of the power of the white men from such intercourse, transmitted to them through their wives. One warrior invited York to his lodge, offered him his wife, and guarded the entrance during the act. York was said to be the big medicine. Whether the Indians got white or black power from the intercourse cannot be said, but what they had gotten for sure from their hospitality to previous white traders was venereal disease, which was rampant in the villages and passed on to the men of the expedition. Still, Sergeant Gass pronounced the Arikara squaws to be the most cleanly Indians I have ever seen, handsome, the best-looking Indians I have ever seen. Sergeant Ordway agreed, noting that some of their women are very handsome and clean. Clark called the Arikara dirty, kind, poor, and extravagant, possessing national pride, not beggarly. They brought corn and squash and other welcome vegetables to the expedition, and quantities of a bean the Indians acquired by digging in the underground storage bins of the meadow mice. Clark called the bean large and well-flavored and very nourishing. It was said that the Indians always left some other food in the place of that they had robbed from the mice. The following day, October 11th, Crow at Rest arrived to make his answer to Lewis's proposals. He said his heart was glad to have a new father, that the road was open to the expedition and would always be open. "Can you think anyone dare put their hands on your rope of your boat?" "No, not one dare." He asked the captains to make a peace between his people and the Mandans. The other two chiefs had not come into council, apparently put off by not having been made first chief, so the next day the captains went looking for them. They found Chief Hay first, surrounded by his warriors. After Lewis reminded the chief of the magnitude and power of our country, Hay gave his own speech. He said his people had no hostility toward the whites, that he hoped the captains would help make a peace with the Mandans, that he might be willing to go to Washington to meet with President Jefferson in the spring, and other welcome words. But he concluded with a request that the captains were in no position to grant. "After you set out," Hay said, "many nations in the open plains may come to make war against us. We wish you to stop their guns and prevent it if possible." Finished. Then it was on foot to the third village, where Hawk's Feather was chief. He, too, was ready with his reply to the American proposals. He, too, was thinking about a trip to Washington. He promised not to make war, but said that he would believe a Mandan-Arikara peace only when he saw it with his own eyes. He gave two blunt warnings. "Maybe we Arikara chiefs will not tell the truth," and "the Indians above the Mandans will not believe your word about peace with the Arikaras." One of the chiefs, unnamed, was willing to find out. He agreed to go on board and make the trip to the Mandans to talk in council sponsored by the American peacekeeping delegation. On October 13th, Clark and Lewis were confronted with a severe disciplinary problem. Former Private Moses Reed, the erstwhile deserter, was a grousing, malcontented soldier who wanted to poison the mind of at least one member of the expedition. Anyone who has ever been in the Army knows Reed's type. For some time past, he had been picking on Private John Newman, agitating him about those blankety-blank captains and how unfair they were and how arbitrary and worse. Newman succumbed to the poison. He lashed out at the captains, who had him and Reed arrested. Reed was beyond their power to punish, but Newman was subject to the Articles of War. The captains convened a court-martial with Clark as president, without giving his opinion, and Sergeant Ordway head of the court. Lewis read the charge that Newman had uttered repeated expressions of a highly criminal and mutinous nature, the same having a tendency not only to destroy every principle of military discipline, but also to alienate the affections of the individuals composing this detachment to their officers, and disaffect them to the service for which they have been so sacredly and solemnly engaged. Newman pled, "Not guilty!" Evidence was presented. Newman made his defense. Whatever Newman said, his peers rejected. The 10 men on the court are unanimously of opinion that the prisoner John Newman is guilty of every part of the charge exhibited against him. The sentence was 75 lashes on the bare back, and to be discarded from the permanent party engaged for Northwestern discovery. Not dismissed, not discharged, but discarded. The captains approved the sentence and set noon the next day for the lashing. They further ordered that Newman join the Frenchmen in the canoes as a laboring hand. On October 14th, the keelboat set out early. At noon, it came to on the starboard side in order to carry out Newman's lashing. The Arikara chief with the boat watched the preparations. He was alarmed very much. When the whipping actually began, the chief cried aloud. Clark explained the cause of the punishment. The chief, he recorded, also thought examples were necessary, and that he himself had made them by death, but his nation never whipped even their children. By October 24th, the expedition was well north of present Bismarck and approaching the Mandan villages. The captains knew from their research in St. Louis and from Mr. Gravelines that the Mandans, and their neighbors and allies, the Hidatsas, were the center of the northern plains trade, attracting Indians from vast distances. At trading time in the late summer, the river villages were crowded with Crows, Assiniboines, Cheyennes, Kiowas, Arapahoes, along with whites from the Northwest Company, the Hudson's Bay Company, and St. Louis businessmen. Nowhere else could one see at a single glance the diversity and colorful lifestyle of the Indians of the plains. There were Spanish horses and mules to buy and sell, fancy Cheyenne leather clothing, English trade guns, baskets of produce, meat products, furs of all kinds, musical instruments, blankets, dressed buffalo hides, painted buffalo hides. During the fair, there was dancing until well into the night, and much visiting back and forth, and competition between the boys. It was a grand time in the five villages. There were two Mandan villages. The lower one, on the west bank, was led by Big White and his second chief, Little Raven. Farther upriver, on the east bank, was the second village, led by Black Cat, with Raven Man Chief as his second in command. On the Knife River, coming in from the west, there were three Hidatsa villages. One of these, 40 lodges strong, was led by Black Moccasin. Another, with over 130 earth lodges, had 450 warriors who were led by Liborgne, or One Eye, a military chieftain of great reputation. The Mandans hunted buffalo on horseback, but they did not ride out on war parties ranging to the Rocky Mountains, whereas the Hidatsas rode the whole way to the snow-covered peaks to make raids and capture horses and slaves. As it moved north, the expedition began seeing Mandan villages, but they were abandoned because the tribe had been decimated by smallpox. As the expedition passed the mouth of the Heart River, center of the old Mandan homeland, the men saw a Mandan Sundance post standing forlorn on the prairie, a silent witness to the past. In the earth lodges, the Americans found scattered bones of men and animals. On the 24th, the captains met their first live Mandans, Chief Big White and a 25-man hunting party. With Gravelines at his side, Lewis introduced Big White to the Arikara chief with great cordiality and ceremony. They smoked a pipe. Lewis, Gravelines, and the Arikara chief accompanied Big White to his village. Peace between the Arikaras and the Mandans seemed possible. The captains were off to a good start with the Indians, who would be their neighbors for the winter. But even with all the good indications about relations with the Mandans, the captains were cautious. On October 26, the expedition was in camp just below the first Mandan village. Indians were all about them. Clark wrote, "Many men, women, and children flocked down to see us." The captains discussed the situation and determined that both would not leave the boat at the same time until we knew the deposition of the natives. Lewis walked to the village with Big White and Gravelines, while Clark stayed on the boat and saw to security. There were over 4,000 Indians in the five villages, about 1,300 of them warriors. Should they so choose, they could quite obviously overwhelm the Corps of Discovery. They would not choose so long as the expedition could make it clear that the Indians would suffer grievously if they attacked, both in lives lost and future trade relations destroyed. Fortunately, the Mandans understood all this and were friendly. Lewis received a warm welcome in Big White's village and was able to extend an invitation to the chiefs of all five villages to come to the expedition's camp for a council. Meanwhile, a trader from the second Mandan village, named René Jessom, paid a visit to Clark. Jessom had been living with the Mandans for 15 years and participated fully in their ceremonial and social life. He had married a Mandan woman and was raising a family in the village. He claimed he had been a spy for General George Rogers Clark during the Revolution, but apparently William Clark did not believe him. In any case, he wrote of Jessom, "Well, to give my ideas as to the impression this man makes on me is a cunning, artful, and insincere." But he was also useful as interpreter and source of information, so Clark hired him on. Relations with the Mandans continued to be excellent. The Indians were delighted that the expedition would spend the next 5 months as their neighbor. On October 28th, Black Cat, Lewis, Clark, and Jessom walked up the river for some distance, looking for a place to build a fort for the winter. The Americans needed good trees and lots of them, and plenty of game. The country they examined that day would not answer. On October 29th, the first formal council was held. Lewis gave his basic Indian speech. To Clark's dismay, the old chief was restless before the speech was half ended. Another chief rebuked him for his uneasiness at such a time. When Lewis finished, Clark introduced the Arikara chief, who smoked with the Mandans. Various promises were made, but Clark complained that the talk was not much to the purpose, because those nations know nothing of regular councils, and know not how to proceed in them, they are restless, etc. Lewis was so busy with the Indians that he forgot to wind his chronometer, but he did find time to take a meridian altitude of the sun with his sextant for latitude. On the morning of the last day of October, Black Cat invited Clark to his lodge to hear what he had to say. Since the captains regarded Black Cat as the first chief of all the Mandans, Clark readily went. Black Cat told Clark that it would fill his heart with joy if there could be a peace between the Arikaras and the Mandans, because if there were, Mandan men could hunt without fear, and our women can work in the fields without looking every moment for the enemy. Then came a rebuke. When the Indians heard of your coming up, they all came in from hunting to see. They expected great presents. They were disappointed, and some dissatisfied. As for Black Cat, however, he was not so much so, but his village was. Still, he would go to meet his great father in Washington in the spring. Lewis, meanwhile, played host to Hugh McCracken, a British trader with the Northwest Company, who had just made a 9-day, 150-mile overland trip from the Assiniboine River post of the company. McCracken was a regular in the village, as were other traders from the Northwest Company and its rival, the Hudson's Bay Company. The British in Canada were the primary suppliers of manufactured goods to the Mandans. This was a situation Lewis intended to change. His policy, Jefferson's policy, was to isolate the Sioux, open the river from St. Louis to the Mandans, and establish an American trading monopoly at this great emporium of the northern Great Plains. But Lewis knew that he needed to be patient. Although he had the legal authority to throw the British traders out of Upper Louisiana, he didn't have the physical force to do so, not when the Indians outnumbered his party by 50 warriors to every soldier. He wouldn't have kicked the British traders out anyway, because they were providing a critically necessary service to the Indians that the Americans were not yet ready to replace. McCracken was setting off on his return journey the next day, November 1st, so Lewis seized the opportunity to establish contact with the British merchants in Canada and explain the new situation to them. While Clark talked to Black Cat, Lewis wrote a letter to McCracken's boss. He started off with a bit of a fib. "We have been sent by the government for the purpose of exploring the River Missouri and the western parts of the continent with a view to the promotion of general science." He added that his party had no intention of disrupting the trade relationship that existed as long as the British acknowledged American sovereignty. Then, as a man who was about to go into a 5-month winter camp surrounded by Indians and only Captain Clark to talk to as an equal, Lewis put in a heartfelt line. "As individuals, we feel every disposition to cultivate the friendship of all well-disposed persons." More specifically, he said he would be grateful in the extreme for any hints in relation to the geography of the country, its productions, etc., which you might conceive of utility to mankind. In short, he invited British traders to come on down for a visit. The British took him up on it. A number of them paid a call, including François-Antoine Larocque and Charles Mackenzie. Each man left a journal record of his visit. Larocque was 20 years old. Born in Quebec, he was educated in the United States. He wrote that he was very politely received by Captains Lewis and Clark and passed the night with them. "Just as I arrived, they were dispatching a man for me, having heard that I intended giving flags and medals which they forbid me from giving in the name of the United States. As I had neither flags nor medals, I ran no risk of disobeying those orders, of which I assured them." Lewis told Larocque that, "The object of our voyage is purely scientific and literary, and in no way concerns trade." Lewis liked the young Canadian and pressed me to remain a couple of days for company. Larocque did. His compass was not working. The glass was broken and the needle would not point due north. He reported, "Captain Lewis fixed my compass very well, which took him a whole day." Larocque was out for adventure and recognized opportunity when he saw it. From his first meeting with the captains, he begged to be allowed to accompany them to the Pacific and back. But the captains were not about to give a clerk in the Northwest Company a free look at the commercial possibilities in the region and said no. Mackenzie's journal entries provide a sharp image of the American captains and the British traders lounging around a table in the captain's quarters, talking about a wide range of subjects. Mackenzie wrote, "Mr. LaRocque and I have nothing very particular claiming attention. We lived contentedly and became intimate with the gentlemen of the American expedition, who on all occasions seemed happy to see us and always treated us with civility and kindness." But some subjects brought out Lewis's Anglophobia. Mackenzie wrote, "It is true Captain Lewis could not make himself agreeable to us. He could speak fluently and learnedly on all subjects, but his inveterate disposition against the British stained, at least in our eyes, all his eloquence." The captain's quarters were in Fort Mandan, which was located on the north bank of the Missouri, some 7 miles below the mouth of the Knife and directly opposite the lower Mandan village. Work on it had begun on November 3rd. Private Joseph Whitehouse recorded in his journal that "all the men at camp occupied their time diligently in building their huts and got them made comfortable to live in." That same day, Lewis paid off in cash the Frenchmen who had paddled the pirogues upriver. Some of them built a pirogue and returned to St. Louis before the river froze. Others stayed to spend the winter with the Indians and return in the spring with Corporal Worthington and the keelboat. Jessome and his squaw moved into camp, providing instant translation capacity. The fort consisted of 2 rows of huts set at an angle with a palisade on the riverside, a gate and a sentry post, plus the swivel gun mounted. The outer walls were 18 feet high. In the event of an Indian attack, it would answer, at least for a while. LaRocque observed, "The fort is made so strong as to be almost cannonball-proof." From the beginning of the work, Indians crossed the river to observe, mingle, and trade with the soldiers. Other visitors also came. On November 4th, Clark recorded that "a French man by name Chabona visited us. He wished to hire and informed us his 2 squaws were Snake Indians." His name was Toussaint Charbonneau. A French Canadian, about 45 years old, he had once worked for the Northwest Company, but was now living among the Hidatsas as an independent trader. His squaws, or wives, were Shoshones, or Snakes, from a band that lived in the Rocky Mountains at the headwaters of the Missouri. They were teenagers who had been captured by a Hidatsa raiding party 4 years earlier at the place where 3 rivers came together to form the Missouri, called the Three Forks. Charbonneau had won them in a bet with the warriors who had captured them. The captains eagerly accepted Charbonneau's offer to sign on as interpreter, not so much for his own sake as because his wives could speak the language of a mountain tribe. The wives could talk to Charbonneau in Hidatsa, he could then talk in French to Drouillard, who could pass it on to the captains in English. From their difficulties with the Sioux, the captains knew how hard it was to communicate with the Indians without a translator. So on the spot, they signed up Charbonneau and one of his wives to go on with us. He chose Sacagawea, who was about 15 years old and 6 months pregnant. Mackenzie got to know Charbonneau and was not much impressed. He noted that translation was more an art form than scientific at Fort Mandan. "Sacagawea spoke a little Hidatsa," he wrote, "in which she had to converse with her husband, who was a Canadian and did not understand English. A mulatto, Jessome, who spoke bad French and worse English, served as interpreter to the captains, so that a single word to be understood by the party required to pass from the natives to the woman, from the woman to the husband to the mulatto to the captains." That might not have been so bad, except that Charbonneau and Jessome argued about the meaning of every French word they used. Another visitor was Big White, the enormously fat, light-skinned Mandan chief. On November 12th, Clark recorded that "Big White came down. He packed about 100 pounds of fine meat on his squaw for us," meaning his wife carried the 100-pound load. Clark gave her some trinkets and a small axe for her labor. On November 20th, warriors from Black Cat's village came to inform the captains that the American peace policy was in danger. 2 Arikara delegates who had gone to the Sioux with a peace offer had been roughed up, had their horses taken from them, and been generally made to realize how angry the Sioux were that the Arikaras had arranged through Clark and Lewis for a peace with the Mandans. There were other meddlers, including the Mandans, who had filled the ears of the Hidatsas with lies. The Mandans had an obvious interest in keeping the Hidatsas away from Fort Mandan, and thus having a monopoly on trade with the expedition. So they told the Hidatsas that the Americans had joined with the Sioux and intended to make war on the Hidatsas. They offered as proof such facts as Jessam's moving into the fort, the strength of the fort, the constant presence of a sentry, and other military preparations. Lewis realized how dangerous it was for the Americans to have the Hidatsas believing such things, so he reacted immediately. He set out on horseback for the Hidatsa villages, accompanied by Jessam and Charbonneau as translators, to make the rounds of the principal men and assure them of the falsity of the Mandan stories. But he was rebuffed. Later that day, he saw Mackenzie. "He observed to me," Mackenzie wrote, "that he was not very graciously received. I sent ahead," said he, "to inform Horned Weasel, the Hidatsa chief, that I intended to take up my quarters at his lodge. He returned for an answer that he was not at home. This conduct surprised me, it being common only among your English lords not to be at home when they did not wish to see strangers, but as I had felt no inclination of entering any house after being told the landlord would not be at home, I looked out for another lodging, which I readily found." In the morning, Lewis and his men returned to Fort Mandan, accompanied by two lesser Hidatsa chiefs. From them, Lewis extracted a promise not to wage war on the Shoshones and Blackfeet, who resided north of the Shoshones, on the eastern edge of the Rocky Mountains. The promise was worthless. A day or two later, the leader of the Wolves, a society of young Hidatsa warriors, took a party of 50 on a raid into Blackfoot territory. So it had always been, and apparently would be. The terms peace and war, as understood by the Americans, had no meaning to the Indians.